It's Friday night, Arena, and we're coming to you again this evening from the Galway International Arts Festival. We open tonight with festival reviews, new plays by Marco Rowe and Marina Carr, and Druid taking on Samuel Beckett's Endgame. All family dramas in very different ways. And we look at two exhibitions, the work of Australian artist Patricia Piccinini and of Lebanese artist Tanya El Khoudry. Mary McGill and Judy Murphy are with me now in our Galway studio. You're very welcome. You've been to see loads for us. Thank you very much. Let's start with Reunion by Marco Rowe. We spoke to Mark yesterday. So it's written by Mark and it's starring Kathy Belton, Robert Sheehan, Stephen Brennan and a host of other characters. There are 10 characters in the play, which is very exciting for us who like big dramas. Mark has adapted Ibsen's Ghosts last year at the Abbey, but this is his first brand new play since The Approach in 2018. So Mary, it's a family get together on an island off the Galway coast to honour their late father.
Yes, so it would seem. So it would seem came in initially. So we get this wonderful set from Frances O'Connor, which shows us the interior of this cottage. And Kathy Belton, as the matriarch, is preparing for the arrival, imminent arrival of her much-loved children. So we get the sense that, yes, Sean, the father, has recently passed away. They are still in mourning. And this is very important to her to have all her children around her. And when the family arrives, initially, it's all very happy-clappy. They've got their partners with them and they all seem to get on very, very well. And they are surprised by the arrival of Gina, who is the sister of the matriarch, played by the wonderful Catherine Walker, who gives a really flighty, excellent performance as Gina in Reunion. And from there on in, Gina kind of symbolises, she's like a harbinger of the high drama which is to come. Because would you believe this seemingly very happy family is not that happy at all? And when things begin to unravel, they unravel with such energy and such a, I keep using the word drama, but that is essentially what Reunion is. It is a non-stop laugh out loud drama from beginning to end, and it just does not let up.
So once we're settled in and we get to know the characters and a little bit of their relationship, which is quite light-hearted at the beginning, even if there's doing a little bit of sniping at each other, what happens then to flip this into serious drama and serious conflict?
I suppose an old flame comes back from the past. He's been a partner of one of the characters.
This is Angus, played by Ian Lloyd Anderson.
Yes, who's been Marilyn's partner when there was children. It reminded me so much of Inishbofin and people going to Inishbofin and places like that. But they used to go there as children. They had this fantastic childhood there. And she went out with Angus. And depending on which particular time she's telling the story at, it was 4 years, 4.5 years or 5 years, but it was quite a complicated relationship. So while the matriarch is preparing the dinner, the women stay at home and sip wine and things, and the lads go off to the local pub, as happens, and they meet Angus in the local pub, who tells them he's married, had met a woman in Germany where he went to work, and they have a child. And they all come back and they're having the dinner and they're having the conversation, and suddenly comments are made about Marilyn's relationship with Angus, and that Angus was sexually inexperienced when he met her, although he was 30, I think, at the time when he met her, and how weird was that? And suddenly it all, that one comment or that one observation suddenly opens a whole can of worms, and it really is downhill from there on. And then Angus arrives to compound matters further.
And there's one character, Mary, who wasn't invited but is brought along. Mm. This is Felix. And what is the purpose of Felix? Is he doesn't quite engage with all the family activity.
No, Stephen Brennan as Felix, I have to say, steals absolutely every scene that he's in. And initially, he's the father of one of the partners of the kids. And initially, you think, oh, he's just there for laughs. And he certainly delivers on that. But as the story progresses and as Felix grows close to one of the characters in particular, we begin to see another side to him. Felix has hidden depths, and this is just a lovely piece of both comedic but also emotional writing from Marco Rowe. And Stephen Brennan in the role, just he's like an awkward uncle shuffling around in the background, but as the play progresses, he becomes something else entirely. And it's just a really wonderful performance. I found myself thinking about it afterwards, smiling, but also been deeply, deeply impressed. Sad exactly.
As well,
So Marco Rowe is a writer who likes to direct his own work. And I mean, that presents two challenges, but he says he likes to have his script very well, very tight, ready to, so that he can direct it then rather than changing as he directs. It's a hard one with 10 people on stage to keep all those balls in the air.
I found that. And as Mary was saying, as he's setting the scene for this normal, happy family going on their homage to the father who has died and stuff like that, and it's all lovely, and it's, I found the first 20 minutes too long for me, because the conversation is about who's going to peel the spuds and who's going to do this and who's going to do that. And it's all grand, but there's too much of it. And
I suppose it helps us to know who's partnered with who, because that's so important later on.
It does. It does. But I just found, God, I could feel myself thinking this is long. And I kind of thought, shouldn't be thinking that I should be rolling with it. And actually, for the first 10 minutes, I was sort of saying, who's with who? How is this working out? So, I mean, that was kind of interfering with the flow of the play for me, trying to figure out what character, because there's 10 of them on stage and you're trying to figure out who's a daughter, who's a son, who's a partner, who's whatever. Mm-hmm. But once that all fell into place, then I thought, I mean, it was quite pacey and it moved along at a rate of knots, but they all have traumas. Like normally when there's a family get together, there might be two people fighting or there might be sort of whatever, but these are all fighting.
Yes, and when these many cats get among the pigeons, Mary, there's wonderful action and movement in the play. It gets more and more frenetic, really, as it goes on.
Yes, and I think that says something about Mark Oroa as writer, but also director. Like, this is so tightly done. The language, everything from the movement to the language, Kay. I mean, I just found myself utterly compelled by the way the characters related to each other. And I have to say, as an Irish person, listening to what Oroa does with language, I mean, I recognise myself in the characters and the way they speak and relate to one another as both lovers, as family members, as Irish people who have a very particular vernacular when it comes to swearing, for example, or slagging each other off, but also the dark side to that and how quickly in a dysfunctional family that kind of, you know, easy jibing can turn into something that's much more dark. And I think he does an absolutely great job of, as you know, Gigi was saying, when the play picks up pace, of creating something that is really, really energetic and true. And I certainly found myself really identifying with the way the characters related to one another.
So I think you would both recommend, maybe you with a little reservation about the beginning, Gigi.
Yeah, but it's a play where, Mary's right, Irish people will see themselves in it and we'll all be grateful that our families mightn't be quite so dramatic when we convene.
So Reunion is written and directed by Marco Rowe. It's in the Black Box Theatre in Galway until the 27th of July. Next up, Marina Carr has her first premiere at the Galway International Arts Festival. It's The Map of Argentina. 40-something Deb, played by Maeve Fitzgerald, has fallen in love with Darby, played by Fiona Leinschik, and he with her. The only problem is Deb is already has a husband, Sam, and is married to him, and they have 5 children at home. And Mark Huberman plays Sam. So, Judy, bring us into this story. She loves her children, she loves her husband, but she has fallen madly in love with this character, Darby.
She has fallen madly in love with the notion of having a relationship or a fling, depending again on the moment she's speaking, before she gets too old to, because she keeps referring to herself as old, or she refers to herself several times as old. And I'm sitting there thinking, you're 40? Like, what? You know, this is a strange kind of thing to be thinking. But this is her chance at happiness. She's been a really good wife. She's been a really good mother. She has been the perfect wife and the perfect mother. And she realises life is passing her by. And her husband hasn't been such a perfect husband or father. And I suppose that's what Marina Carr does. She explores the things that when a woman wants to maybe sort of opt to have a bit of freedom and to kick over the traces and stuff like that, that it's never as simple as it is when a man does it. and that there are far more expectations placed on a woman.
Yes, there are consequences to actions. Isn't that what she is saying in this play? And there are other characters in the play who have made those decisions, maybe to fall madly in love and leave the family home. And they have suffered consequences for that. Bring us into those characters, Mary.
So I suppose both Deb and Sam are haunted by the decision. I won't give too much away, but they're haunted by the decisions of their own parents with regard to following their heart, shall we say, and what that did to their own family situations and their parents' relationships. And although they never connect that expressly in the play, there is that spectre of what we hand down to our children through the decisions that we make, whether to stay in a marriage or not. And Deb is wrestling with that question. And it is, I think, you know, as Judy was saying, it's a particular question for women. Do I stay or do I go? And I think Cara is very good at acknowledging that there are different stakes. And I think the play is very much concerned with this question of consequences and how the consequences can echo down through generations. But I agree with Judy. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes the way Deb talks about being 40 and about, you know, the way her life is running out, I found that kind of hard to relate to, maybe a bit overwrought. But I nevertheless, I do feel that it is, you know, the play is a very interesting exploration of that sense of our lives, wanting to reassert control over our lives, maybe wanting to be a bit reckless, maybe wanting to throw off all the shackles and go a bit mad. You know, her, you know, Deb's relationship with Darby isn't particularly well defined. She doesn't care. Like, she really is willing to throw it all away on this bit of a cad. And you can identify with that, but also think, you're mad, woman. Like, what are you doing? So it is an interesting push and pull. And I think, I mean, what I got from it is that there are simply no easy answers if you find yourself in this type of situation.
Yes, and there are flights of imagination in it, aren't there, Judy? Particularly in the character of Laura, played by Brigitte Nocton. Oh. We won't get into it too much because we don't want to give it away, but it is where the Argentinian reference comes in.
The title relates to it, yeah, and it's wonderful. And there is an Argentinian of sorts. He's there somewhere and he has a particular relationship with the character of Laura, played by Brigitte Nocton, has had a particular relationship. And this guy, can I say what he does for a living?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's a heart surgeon. And he has a particular habit when he goes to the operating theatre of, he has an animal and the animal comes to the operating theatre with him and stuff happens with the operating theatre.
Yes, he's useful. The dog is useful.
The dog eats the scraps and things like that. So it's pretty good. And then towards the end of the play, he reappeared. This man is long gone, but he reappears in a form because it's Mina Carr. It's a bit wacky and it's a bit kind of surreal, but it's absolutely brilliant. And his arrival is kind of presaged by this tango music. And it's really kind of quirky and funny and kind of mad.
Yes,
really.
Mary, performances and the direction of Andrew Flynn.
I mean, can I just say, like, the performances in The Map of Argentina were just brilliant. And to have seen The Map of Argentina and Reunion, which we've just discussed so closely together, the standard of acting in this country, Kay, is just so incredibly strong. And I'm only sorry that we can't have more productions to show it off, like these large ensemble pieces. Great acting, great directing as well from Andrew O'Flynn in The Map of Argentina.
Yes, and as it was Mary saying there, these are intense, kind of passionate relationships in both of the plays. And that calls for, you know, very young actors doing, you know, really spilling their guts.
And working really closely together. And I mean, you didn't just imagine that the energy and the effort that goes into these productions. And what I found, what amazed me and what I found so fantastic about The Map of Argentina was the younger, because there are five children in this play of varying ages, and they were fantastic. And child actors can be tricky to manage it all on stage, but it was really good. And what I found absolutely fascinating was the two little girls in The Map of Argentina, who were physically taking lumps out of each other as they were moving over and back along the couch, manipulating the parents, were the mirror image of the two older girls in Reunion who had arrested development and who were verbally taking scalps out of each other.
All right, so I think you both like The Map of Argentina.
Yes.
Yeah, very much so. And that's on at the Thaiverk.
Yeah.
Now, Kelly Hughes and actor Alwyn Fuere direct our next play. It's Unspeakable Conversations, a two-hander with Liz Carr, an actor people may know as Clarissa in the BBC's Silent Witness, and Matt Fraser. So, Judy, Liz Carr and Matt Fraser play Harriet McBurn and Peter Singer. Who are they and what is unspeakable conversations? What are the conversations that should not be spoken?
Unspeakable Conversations is based on an article written by Harriet McBride in the New Yorker about 20 years ago.
2003, I think.
Yeah. When she recalled an event at Princeton University, a debate that she attended with Peter Singer, Peter Singer is a philosopher, a very well-known philosopher born in Australia and best known or very well known as an animal rights activist. But Peter Singer posited the theory that children with disabilities, a possibility to put them down at birth because their lives would be of lesser quality and their parents should have the option to decide whether to euthanize them at birth. And this woman was a disability activist. She was in a wheelchair herself and she was a lawyer. So she took exception to this and they ended up having a debate in Princeton and she took him on and they discussed it. And they ended up actually having a cordial personal relationship, even though their beliefs didn't tally at all. So that's the backdrop to the story. Christian O'Reilly, who is a fantastic writer living here in Galway, who wrote No Magic Pill last year, 2 years ago, which was about the story of Martin Nocton, an activist from Spiddle. Christian took on this play and with the help of Alman Frere and dramaturgy and stuff like that, moulded it into this and got Matt Fraser and Liz involved. And it's just an extraordinary. Right.
So are the discussions that Judy is talking about there about euthanasia and the rights of people with disability, are they all worked out in the action of the play?
Yeah, so the play is a very interesting combination of Liz and Matt playing, you know, Harriet and Peter respectively. So we get direct quotes from the debate in Princeton, but also from Harriet's beautiful piece where she, you know, as Judy was describing, reflects on that debate. But we also get Liz and Matt's own experiences as disabled actors growing up in a very able-bodied world. And these two together, I mean, their charisma is off the charts. They're clearly very much enjoying themselves, but they also have a lot to say. And they're also quite angry, as you can understand, about the fight that they have had, the struggle that they have had to get to a point, I suppose, in their careers where they can do a production like this and reflect on the struggle that it has taken to get to this point.
And are the actors very open about their own disabilities? Is that part of the script?
Absolutely. I mean, so much so that I think some of the people in the audience with me were a bit shocked. You know, there are parts of this that are quite outrageous. And like, what really drew me to Unspeakable Conversations initially was, you know, at the moment we're culturally at a point where it's actually quite hard to have difficult conversations. But this production revels in a very difficult conversation and it takes it and it cracks it open and it shows you. I mean, I really felt the power of performance and theatre in this to kind of hold this difficult discussion up to the light. But I also felt the power of public debate and intellectual curiosity. Like Harriet and Peter had two very different perspectives. But as she says herself, they met as intellectual equals and they talked and they reflected and they engaged. They used to write letters to each other. And sitting, you're just reminded of what that kind of connection can be, but also what the theatre can do to bring those difficult discussions out and have audiences engage with them.
And Judy, I know there's humour in it, but is it shocking? Are the conversations shocking?
Well, as Mary says, some of them are kind of shocking because they're talking about their first sexual experiences and stuff, and they're not holding back.
Nope.
I mean, they're telling you what's happening. And there's at the very beginning where Matt throws off his prosthetic arms and they just like, and he explains, and he does an imitation of a T-Rex because he's a thalidomide baby. So his arms are, you know, the kind of the shape that kind of, there's a name on it that I can't.
But, I think he says they're like seals, baby seals.
Like baby seals,
yeah.
And so absolutely. And then they have this slagging of each other about who's the more famous actor. And he says to her, you know, West End shows and who would you, like, you're only picking me because I'm the only one available. And I mean, there's one absolute brilliant thing where he plays Peter Singer, who's Australian. He does it in an Australian accent. And he said, you'd rather Hugh Jackman, wouldn't you, than me? But he wasn't available. And they do this thing about put the crippled kids down, sung to the tune of Tie My Kangaroo Down, and then they invite the audience to join in. And I mean, obviously, the audience did not join in. But I mean, you're looking at them, you're thinking, you're pushing boundaries, but you can do this because of where you are. You know, but they're also challenging us because at one point, speaking as Matt and Liz, he says to her, you know, if we had done this play here 20 years ago, they'd only have been ourselves and our PA and our social workers. And she said, yes, this is true, and we have a full house, but we're still having the same conversation. Mm. And that is the absolute. And they go into things like assisted dying and suicide and, you know, that sort of stuff. And they really do make you think, even as while you're laughing. And they're moving. I mean, she's whizzing around the stage in her wheelchair and she's like a whirling dervish, and they dance and they dance around each other. And it's just beautiful. But they make you think.
Both of you, I think, had a very good night, a very provocative night, a very entertaining as well, given the humour.
Very entertaining.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's Unspeakable Conversations, and that's at the Mick Lally Theatre in Druid Lane until the 27th of July. Druid, of course, is a mainstay of the Galway International Arts Festival. This year, they're taking on Beckett's Endgame, in which a man, his parents and his servant grudgingly share the same living space. Judy, you've been to see this. I think, Mary, you haven't got to see it yet. So, Beckett would even have said that Endgame is a difficult play to stage. Tell us about the four characters and the difficulties around it. First of all, there are physical difficulties.
Well, there are physical difficulties. There's Clove, who is the first character we meet on the stage, who's manoeuvring around and moving ladders and crippled and looking kind of out of kilter and out of comfort. And everything else is kind of still as he comes in, and there's a seat of furniture, there's a piece of furniture, and he pulls the sheet off the seat, piece of furniture, and sitting under this piece of furniture is Ham. Clove can't sit down, Ham can't stand up. So there, Ham is the master, Rory Nolan, Aaron Monaghan is Clove, and they have this extraordinary relationship, and then somebody knocks on one of the bins and up pops a head, and it's his father, Neg, Ham's father, Neg, and then the mother, Nell, is in the other bin, Bosco Hogan and Marie Mullen.
And banished there by their son, Ham.
Banished there by their son, Ham. And you can kind of, like, Ham isn't a particularly nice guy, although he's wonderfully imperious in his older ways. He's not particularly nice, but there's a wonderful exchange between Ham and his father, Neg, where Ham says to him, like, why did you beget me? And I'm not, that's not exactly the word. And the father says, well, I didn't know it would be you. And they talk about how when he was a baby, that they used to put him far away. The father used to put him far away so they wouldn't hear him crying and they could get on with their own lives. And now they're all confined in this room because something dreadful has happened in the world outside. So
it's post-apocalyptic or something as awful has happened.
Yeah.
So even though they're in the bins and put there by Ham, things are bad anyway.
Things are bad anyway. I mean, it's not particularly great inside either, but I presume it's obviously worse outside, although we can't see outside because the only two windows in the room are so high up that Clove has to get on a stepladder every time, and eventually he stops even trying to go on the stepladder because Ham is blind, so he can't see whether he goes up or not. So he eventually pretends to go up and look out the windows and stuff like that and see what's happening outside.
All right. And Judy, is it how well is it presented? I mean, there was one at the Gay Theatre in Dublin not so long ago. I think one in the Project done by Pan not so long ago. It's not that we don't see Endgame a lot. What do Druid bring to it?
Well, I do wonder. Did we need another production of it? I'm not entirely sure we did. Having said that, it's a very good production. The two lads are brilliant, Marie Mullen and Bosco Hogan. I mean, and the relationship between, as I say, Ham and his father, and the tenderness that exists between Neg and Nell, who obviously did have and they keep talking about yesterday and the past, and, you know, and yet there's a kind of a bitterness where she says nothing is as funny as unhappiness. So it's very Beckettian. I mean, there's no question about that. It's a really good production and they're wonderful. And it does make you come out of the theatre and you are obviously thinking about the way humans live and what our lives are about and the way we're all interdependent. And yet we don't always like each other, but that this is we're all stuck in this world together. Mm-hmm. And
the staging is often the attractive thing about Beckett.
I thought the staging was wonderful. I thought Frances O'Connor's set was really, really, it's powerful. The lighting is terrific. The sense of the space in the room and the oppression in the room and the bins are fantastic. And, you know, the kitchen where Clove, you don't go to see the kitchen, but you see him sort of shuffling off into the kitchen every now and again to get the peace and quiet that he wants, because it's a servant-master relationship and Ham is quite the master. And Clove wants kind of peace and quiet and Ham can't shut up.
Well, I think you'd recommend that, Judy.
I did enjoy it. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Endgame is at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, and that's on until the 28th of July. Now, Patricia Piccinini is an artist. Her exhibition, We Travel Together, is at the Festival Gallery. And Mary, you went to see that. I spoke to Patricia yesterday, and we'll play that tape shortly. But give us your impression of it.
Well, Patricia's returning after a record-setting 2015 when she exhibited here in Galway, and she was a huge hit with the audiences. And We Travel Together kind of continues one of the key themes in her work, which is, unfortunately, humanity's very destructive relationship with nature. Now, in Patricia's vision, nature is both familiar and very strange. She specialises in the creation of kind of hybrid creatures. So when you walk into the gallery at the moment, you're greeted by a tall rat that appears to be made of human flesh, but it also has long hair, fangs, and painted nails that are hot pink. And so you're kind of confronted, Kay, because on the one hand it looks familiar, but it looks very strange. But you stop and you look, and immediately you are in her world, and that is what she is so good at doing. One of the central pieces of this year's exhibition is a beautiful diorama of what looks to be a forest. It could even be a rainforest that is clearly in decline. And it feels like almost like something from a fairy tale. And it's populated with all of these strange creatures that she conjured up. And it is this effect. You're looking, going, this could be real. I know it's not. It is both creepy. It is beautiful. And it's just, and I think, in the space that they have in there, you are immediately transported, but you're also confronted with this reality, and this is what she's trying to get across, of the vastness of nature and our interconnectedness with nature, but also the way we are compromising that through human activity.
So very briefly then, Judy, if we could go to the cultural exchange rate, which you went to in the university today.
It's in the Olimax in the university, and you go in and you're handed a set of keys. A huge key ring that you'd see in an institution with 10 keys on it, and you are given a set of brief instructions. You follow these instructions and you go to a series of, I suppose you'd call them safes or boxes or strong boxes, and you peer your head into all of them, or in some cases you open doors and you go into them, and you see the story of this Syrian Mexican family, or Lebanese Syrian family, and the whole exploration that she has about identity, borders, who we are, how we have to struggle to, people have
the
to struggle.
The artist is Tanyel Khari.
How we have to struggle to find, or people have to struggle to find their place in the world, and finding your identity, and how colonial powers have ruined the lives of so many people by imposing borders and imposing cultural sort of mores on people, where they have no right to be going, and how that has affected so many people in society.
Yes, well, it's a very experiential event, and it's called Cultural Exchange Rate. It's at the Aula Maxima at the University of Galway until the 28th of July. My thanks to Judy Murphy and Mary McGill for going to all those shows for us. Thank you both very much. Further details for these shows and more on giaf.ie. I went to the Festival Gallery yesterday to the We Travel Together exhibition and met with the artist Patricia Piccinini, who Mary McGill referred to in her reviews of the festival. The sculptures you encounter, as Mary said, are vaguely familiar, yet fantastical, as if some future species had arrived in the world. The sculptures are at once unsettling, yet charming. I met Patricia Piccinini and asked her about the work.
We're in this beautiful cavernous space. It's quite industrial. It's just off the main street, Shop Street in Galway, which is just full of people swimming by like salmon. As we enter, we feel immediately on our skin a kind of coolness, moistness indeed. And we smell a little bit of mustiness, which is not like a forest, but it gives us the impression of being in a different space immediately, without even being cognizant of it. And we encounter a diorama. Dioramas are environments that we normally see in museums of natural history. We're familiar with them because We've gone and seen them as children, and they're a kind of way of understanding the way we categorise and understand the nature that we live with or in.
So we're in a little forest, really, and there we encounter creatures.
That's right. It's actually quite a large diorama, even by museum standards. And inside this diorama, there are all these inhabitants, and they are artificial creatures that look real. And a diorama is an artificial space representing a natural environment. So what we're getting is a sense of dichotomies.
And tell us about the creatures that we encounter. I describe them as strange. They're almost human-like or animal-like because they've got pink skin, but then they may have scales or strange hair, things that maybe upset people or make them think it's rather strange.
Yes, Kay, they're chimeras. And chimeras are creatures without borders. They're fluid. We see them a lot in mythologies, like the Minotaur is a chimera. They have a lot of humanness, as you say. Yes, they have human eyes often, and skin that we can recognise sometimes. And I make chimeras because they are the ones that help us reapprise this dichotomous relationship with nature. Because it is this distinction between nature and culture that is keeping us or has led us to this situation that we find ourselves in with the climate crisis. Because we believe we're not part of nature. Nature's over there. So if this creature over here dies off, it doesn't really matter because I'm in the city over here. It doesn't really affect me. But indeed, it does affect us. It does. If these things do eventually, and we will see imminently, really affect us.
When the viewer encounters these creatures.
Yes.
What are you hoping that they... I mean, you understand that people might be repulsed at the beginning, but you're hoping that they might be drawn to the similarities as much as the difference.
What I imagine happens is that people approach them and they look at them and they go, oh, I don't recognise that. It's unknown to me, but it's slightly familiar and it perhaps could have evolved. Because it's not alien, it's got a skeletal system like ours. I can see things of myself in it. I can connect with it somehow. And then perhaps that journey in might start. So I hope the journey from aversion to intrigue, and possibly even something stronger than intrigue, maybe something closer to engagement, connection, even love. There's a lot of love in this work. Like, you can love these works. They're lovable. Because I depict often relationships, and these relationships are often tender ones. Ones of connection, ones of nurturing, ones of care.
So when we go through the exhibition into where they're showing the film, we come across a caravan. And in this, there's an intimate scene of a couple in bed. But they're not human. They look human. Just describe the couple.
Well, yes, they're chimeras. They're half bear, half human. They are in this very loving and caring embrace. And interestingly, the female is slightly vigilant. She's active. So it's interesting to have her be in that position, which we don't often see in intimacy. So the male isn't being looked after like a child, but he's able to rest. They have this loving nest of a place that they've created for themselves, and perhaps they're on the run, perhaps they live on the outskirts of society, perhaps they're just teenagers and they're just feeling alienated like everyone else. But they're here and they have their own... It looks like that they have their own destiny. They have a bit of autonomy over their lives.
And you said you were inspired by this, by Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, exactly, because... Well, she's my hero. I really love that work. I read it when I was really young, and it's been very inspiring to me because it's the story of a father who doesn't care for his offspring.
This is Victor Frankenstein, who creates the so-called monster.
That's right. And he doesn't care for him for no good reason. And the monster goes out and he learns about love by spying on other people. Then he comes back to his father and says, please give me a mate so I can live my wretched life, as he says. And Frankenstein says, yeah, okay. But when the monster comes to pick up his mate, Frankenstein eviscerates the female in front of his eyes, and then there's just violence and destruction. There's no going back. The monster kills everyone. And what Mary Shelley is saying is, if you don't care for what you create, you can expect dark times.
Now, then we move on to a beautiful film, which is filmed in your native Australia.
Yeah. This is another love story, but it's between a woman and a created creature, a new life. And it's shot in Victoria, in these beautiful, surreal areas, this big, huge salt plain, which is just, like, just mind-blowing. And the story talks about how this connection allows the woman to re-enchant the environment, country, the bush. That's what love can do. That's what care can do. So she falls in love with this creature, and she now can see the space around her in new eyes. It all becomes slightly magical. It's re-enchanted, and she's able to have a new relationship with nature. We're not quite sure what it is, but all of a sudden these things happen, like these magical plants happen that have spores like coral into the sky. It becomes slightly science fiction-y, like Mary Shelley, but not quite. It's all slightly conceivable, but not really. And then she does what a lot of humans find hard to do. She lets her love go, because that's what he needs in the world. He needs to be with his own people in country, in nature. And that's tough for us, because we don't like giving up our comforts and our love. But she does it. But it's not quite so simple, because we have a whole history of introducing new species into the environments where they don't emerge from and causing havoc, like foxes in Australia that just like eat all the marsupials. You know, there's so many of these stories. So it's a slightly fraught love affair and story.
And you also said about, you know, that new life is being created now in laboratories through DNA and through all kinds of experimentation. Mm-hmm. And you're just guarding in the way Victor Frankenstein should have been guarded about the creation of life, the responsibility there is to the life you create.
Yes. I mean, this work is of its time and place. We all know about CRISPR. We all know about new vaccines for cancer. In fact, we're looking forward to them. I certainly am. We all know that we're on the verge of a biological revolution, in the same way that Mary Shelley knew that she was on the verge of an industrial revolution. We all know this. This work is not possible without the science narratives that we are steeped in. And that is why I make it, because they inform the work, because it informs our life. And there's lots of opportunities to do great things, to care, to save things that are in a kind of perilous situation. I don't feel that this is dystopic in any way. I don't think it's monstrous. I don't think it's negative. I think it's actually full of moments of joy and opportunity to imagine a new way of relating to nature. And that's what we need.
We Travel Together by artist Patricia Piccinini is at the Festival Gallery on William Street in Galway until July the 28th. On Farlia is a Galway International Arts Festival show presented by Fibbean Sataivyark. It promises to be a late-night spectacle on the pier in the Claddagh Basin, with references to Irish mythology and Greek tragedy. Fibbean Sataivyark, in association with Galician National Theatre and Triator, are bringing this production to Galway International Arts Festival. I'm joined by the director of the show, Fran Nunes, and Derek O'Toole, CEO and co-founder of Fibeen Media. You're both so welcome. So, Fran, tell me the story that you're going to present in this spectacular way on the Clada Basin.
I'm for Lia, this and a story written by Philip Doherty. And it's like the traditional Irish story of people that disappear into the sea, into the ocean, a family drama, a village drama. But it's more like that because Philip brings a new concept of what happened. It's about mythology. It's like the sea that asks for bodies, or is something more. It's the human condition that destroys everything and creates the problem.
Because it's a story about greed, isn't it, as well? You know, there's this man called Brennan, and he owns the canning factory, and he now is Mr. Big in the whole area, who is taking away the livelihoods of other fishermen. And then one family stand up to him.
Yeah, it's the family of Duffy said that, no, I will fish like all the times, like my family did for the history. And that's the conflict. The canning factory owner, Brennan, and the Duffy's family. And in one moment of the story, Duffy's family disappear. Duffy and the three sons. And that's the main idea of the show. Why they disappear? Is because of the unfair lead?
Right. And what can you tell us about the unfair lead?
Yeah, Amphelia is the idea, the concept of a creature or something mythological that asks for bodies into the sea. In Galician,
a kind of sacrifice.
Yeah, it's like, but it's always, you know, the ocean brings to us food, you know, and in all the maritime cultures, we know that ask for bodies too. In Galicia, we called modas or, you know, whatever, but it's the same in every culture from Brittany to Wales to Ireland, Galicia. We have something in common, and that tribute to the ocean, but this is really painful for the society.
And everybody in a coastal community would have heard Escaelge would be Tuigan an Arriga Chujain, and the sea takes its own always back. So this is a way, I suppose, historically and for millennia, to explain tragedy and what has happened.
Because yes, from Peg Sayers to John Millington saying
exactly, these
writers have been suffused with those ideas about tragedy and the sea, and to give them some kind of meaning, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And the reason for these tragedies that have happened. And, you know, in the Fear Lia, I suppose the Fear Lia is the sea, is the ocean. And Philip is leaning into that mythology. But actually, there is a twist at the end, which is bring it into more contemporary time.
Yeah, and Derek, this is a really dramatic story. So why did you have to supersize this and take it outside into the weather?
Well, I suppose Fibeen traditionally, or for many years now, has been producing big outdoor spectacles. And it's a playground that we really enjoy working in. And it's a place that we really want to go to the audience and bring the audience on a new experience. And working with Fran, you know, it's a privilege to us, who I met through the Fone project, which I can talk about in a second. But Fibeen always saw itself as a kind of a European, looking outward as a European company, and to have the opportunity to have somebody like Fran from Galicia to bring that aesthetic to Fibeen production was a huge and exciting opportunity for us, and we're delighted that it's happening.
Because you've done such exciting projects around commemoration, and then you did a rock opera recently in a park during the festival. So tell us about this project that makes connections with Galicia and other groups with minority languages, if that's fair to say.
Sure, yeah. So we were invited onto this project 3 years ago. It's coming to an end now. This is the final year for, and it'll finish, I think, April of next year. But the Fone project, it's called, and it's basically to highlight minority language speakers. So it's focusing on the 50 plus million minority speakers of languages in all over Europe. And this project has 8 countries in it, involved in it. And for the last 3 years, we have been mixing, exchanging ideas, and not just of all types of artists, actors and writers, but also technicians. So it's been an amazing project to bring everybody together, to learn from each other, because what is fascinating for me is the different styles and the way other countries are working in their own languages. So there is the Cranny language, which is a brand new theatre company started in 2022. There's very few speakers of it, and it's their first theatre. And then you have, to the other extreme, maybe Galicia, Centro Dramático, which has a massive population, which wouldn't be qualified as a minority language, but maybe more of a minoritized language. So there's all these very different structures. So it's been fascinating from that aspect, and also the aspect of the way people work and produce work. So if you take in Breton, Piba Theatre, they take 2 to 3 years to develop a show, which is mind-blowing to us. Also, Fran does a lot of work, which is very interesting to us. He started rehearsals back in March and April. So traditionally, Irish theatre is an intensive period where you have 4 to 5 weeks rehearsals, then you produce, and then it's all taken down. Where Fran, when he approached me, he goes, oh, I will start work in March. And I said, well, the festival's in July. And he goes, well, I do a week, then I go away, do another week. And he's producing shows all over the world like this, which is an amazing way to work, because the artists and the actors and everybody actually gets to live with the project much longer. So they're kind of, they do a week, an intensive week, and then they go away, but they're living with it for that whole period of 6 months, which is a fascinating way to work.
So, Fran, tell us about this show then. What is going to be the experience for the actors and also for us, the audience?
Yeah, I think it will be a really interesting experience, really exciting, because it's like Dara yesterday defined the idea as like a podcast, but a visual podcast, because all the audience will have headphones with the music and the voices, but at the same time they will see the big pictures, the big actions and choreographies related to the sounds, to the music. And it's a really, the idea of headphones brings the opportunity to be really precise in the sound. You know, you could have a whisper of the characters, you could have a really precise music, and it will be experience, because we will have divers in the show. That is like
divers.
Yeah.
So we're going into the Far Lea.
Yeah. Looking for the Far Lea. You know, if we are looking for the Far Lea, divers are necessary. Totally.
Okay. So is this a good time to play some of the music?
Perfect.
But yes, let's listen to this, and it'll give us some of the atmosphere of the show.
Through the market and
some of the soundtrack there from An Fear Leabh. So, Fran, what is happening when we're hearing that music?
That music is a moment when Daffy returns from the ocean to ask Brennan why their sons are not buried in that moment. And is one of the most powerful moments of the show.
So there's a big confrontation between Duffy, who wanted to stay fishing, and the cannery big man, Brennan.
Yeah, and it's the moment when the voice of the woman of the sea, that is like the narrator of all the scene, is telling us what happened. And what's interesting, the atmosphere, the music that mix the traditional Irish music with contemporary music and with Galician traditional music. And I think it's really powerful.
Yeah.
And these images, how are these, this scenography, I think you call it, Fran, how is that going to evolve in front of people? What are you using, special effects or puppetry or a mixture?
We will use everything because we have a big puppet made in Galicia with shipwreck materials collected in the beach, and we'll have a digger, a pontoon with water, divers, and it's because we will look for all the elements related to the ocean to bring an experience to the audience.
You wouldn't believe how calm Derek is there listening to Fran. Are you not terrified of how you're going to put this together?
We're not terrified. There's a really excellent team on it, I have to say, and we're really fortunate to have the likes of Becky Haley and Katrina Ronald as the main actors on this production. It is a really exciting show because we're creating something, especially as a company that's kind of from the West Coast, creating something on the water, under the water and above the water. And it's very immersive because the challenge we had from day one was how do we block out Galway City in the middle of July in the Arts Festival? Because we're right down in the heart of, anybody knows Galway, right very close to the Spanish Arch. And that's why we came up with this device to put headphones on everybody. So it gives that really immersive experience, and it's everybody's going around with headphones right now. So it's going to be, as Fran said, a visual podcast in a way where you will be completely taken out of the city. And there is, as Fran said, divers, diggers, Galway hookers, stuff happening under the water and above the water. So it's really exciting and all in an hour's time.
And how many people can you facilitate in the crowd? How many people can you give headphones to?
Around 200, 300 people?
Yeah, at the same time. There's enough for 300 people per production. So it's only on for 3 nights.
3 days. That's the 25th, 26th, 27th of July. And that's 10 p.m. at the Claddagh Basin. So you get that nice nighttime experience.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And also, I'd love to mention, if I could, a little plug where we are having an international day or international night where Triater is coming from Holland. They speak Frisian language and they will be performing a sample of their big summer production in Antaivjerk at 2 o'clock. And also Centro Dramático, the National Theatre of Galicia, will be performing a sample of their work. And it's completely free of charge for the audience. And it's an excellent experience to see other European theatre and how they do it. And there'll be an opportunity to meet the artists.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Fran and Derek, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about An Fear Liath. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields. John Doyle was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.